Judge Torres, running January 10th to 19th at the Milagro Theater in Portland. Judge Torres is a modern-day fairy tale rooted in Salvadoran folklore. Xiomara Torres faces many obstacles in her turbulent journey crossing the border, maneuvering the U.S. foster care system, missing her family, aging out, and becoming the most recent Latinx judge in Multnomah County, Oregon. This is her story. Again, that's Judge Torres, running January 10th through 19th, weekly on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at 7:30 p.m. and Sunday at 2 p.m. at the Milagro Theater, 525 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information is available at kbu.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 9 o'clock. Coming up next on Alternative Radio, author and journalist Chris Hedges lays out the roots of a failed system. At 10, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, and at 11, Peace, Love, and Soup presents a holiday special, A Big Ball of Wassail. All of this KBOO programming is made possible by member support. If you're not a member and you'd like to become one, please go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
Trump is the creation of a failed system. And you can remove Trump, but if you don't address the system itself, then especially, I fear, as we barrel towards both an ecological and an economic crisis, out of that swamp will rise figures as frightening or more frightening than Trump. Demagogues who actually have an ideology, clutching the American flag in one hand and the Christian cross in the other. We have to address the root causes.
That's Chris Hedges, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Chris Hedges on root causes of a failed system. Our political life today is like a reality show. There's a fascination with celebrities, from Kanye West to the Kardashians to the former host of The Apprentice. And the soundtrack in the background is permanent war. To talk about these issues is Chris Hedges. He's an award-winning journalist who's reported from the Balkans, the Middle East, and Central America. He writes a weekly column for TruthDig.com. He's the author of many books, including The World as It Is, Wages of Rebellion, and America, the Farewell Tour. He spoke in Eugene, Oregon. And now, Chris Hedges.
Well, this is where hope is, right here in this room. It's with us. And we have a difficult task before us, one that won't be easy, that will require communal solidarity and self-sacrifice, because these corporate elites won't go without a fight. And they will play dirty, and they will be vicious. And I'm sure I'm not the only one in this room who was at Standing Rock, that great heroic effort led by indigenous communities. The water protectors who understood that there are certain elements around us which are sacred, which have an intrinsic value beyond a monetary value, and which are worth fighting to protect and save. The last few years, I have written several books that have attempted to diagnose the deep malaise within American society, the failure of our democratic institutions, the bankruptcy of our political elites, including the Democratic Party, the collapse of our press into burlesque, the shift away from a print-based culture, one rooted in truth and verifiable fact into a culture where fact is interchanged with opinion, where we are skillfully manipulated by corporate forces to elicit emotional responses to everything around us, including manufactured political personalities, and we confuse how we are made to feel with knowledge. The problem in American society has been orchestrated by corporate forces, by a corporate coup d'etat in slow motion, as John Ralston Saul points out, which has transformed American society into a version of the late Roman Republic, the facade of democratic process, electoral politics, civil liberties, a court system that defends the rights of citizens remains. But internally, corporations have seized all of the levers of power. And there's a great, probably our greatest political philosopher, Sheldon Wolin, taught at Berkeley, later at Princeton, who writes in his classic work, Democracy Incorporated, that there are no institutions left within American society that can authentically be called democratic. That we live in what he describes as a system of inverted totalitarianism. And by that, he means it's not classical totalitarianism. We still have the iconography and language of the republic, of a democratic system. But the primacy of economics, the ideology of neoliberalism, which calls on us to kneel before the dictates of the marketplace, to structure our society around the primacy of profit, has essentially turned those institutions and the democratic system into a facade. Anytime a cabal seizes power, whether it's monarchical, communist, fascist, or corporate, and it redirects the institutions that once made incremental and piecemeal reform possible towards accumulating a greater concentration of wealth among the elite and amassing ever greater systems of power, it fosters, in essence, political paralysis. The system works only for a tiny segment of the ruling oligarchic class and becomes increasingly oppressive to the majority of citizens. I wrote a book called Death of the Liberal Class, which is a study of liberal institutions and what has happened to them within American society. And in the corruption and destruction of the liberal class, which in a capitalist democracy should function as a kind of safety valve to ameliorate the stresses and suffering within the society. We saw an example of this with the breakdown of capitalism in the 1930s. And the response by the ruling oligarchic class under Roosevelt, and Roosevelt in his private correspondence, in the letters published after his death, writes that if we in the oligarchic elite do not respond, we will get revolution. Those are Roosevelt's words. So we must If the private sector cannot create jobs, then we as government must create jobs. And Roosevelt creates 12 million jobs. Social Security. Many of the unionists who rose up in the 1930s had not been members of a union previously, especially after the assault against unions following World War I. That's how a functioning liberal class works. The liberal class was never designed to be the political left. It responded to populist movements, the Progressive Party, the CIO, the Communist Party, who we have erased from our history. But corporate forces, frightened by the uprisings in the 1960s, what the political scientist Samuel Huntington called the excess of democracy, followed the 1971 Lewis Powell memo, the blueprint by which they used corporate power, corporate influence, and corporate money to corrupt and finally destroy those institutions within a society, including academia, that are tasked with providing a critique of the society and making sure that civil and political discourse remains rooted in verifiable fact. And the poster child for the faux liberal class is Bill Clinton, who passes NAFTA, the greatest betrayal of the American working class since the 1948 Taft-Hartley Act, who signs into law the 1994 Omnibus Crime Bill, which explodes the system of mass incarceration from roughly 700,000 to over 2 million by the end of his presidency. And it wasn't just that he expanded the prison population. He and Joe Biden and the other Democratic leaders, intent on seizing back the quote-unquote law and order issue, created these draconian laws where people could be imprisoned for life without parole for nonviolent offenses, primarily drug offenses. Half of the people today within our prison system, 2.3 million citizens, were never charged with physically harming another person. And of course, most of them are poor people of color who come from the deindustrialized pockets that were created or certainly accelerated by the flight of manufacturing overseas, courtesy of NAFTA. It was Clinton that passed the welfare reform bill, which obliterated our welfare system, and 70% of the original recipients under our old welfare system were children. It was Clinton that deregulated the FCC and has allowed a handful of five or six corporations to control what 90% of Americans listen to or watch. And it was Clinton who ripped down the firewalls between commercial and investment banks by destroying Glass-Steagall, which precipitated the national and global financial meltdown. After eradicating the populist, progressive movements in this country, and we had a very radical tradition, especially on the eve of World War I, paid for, of course, with the blood of the American working class and African Americans who were intent upon opening up the closed space created by design by the white slaveholding aristocratic elites, the so-called founding fathers. I've taught in a prison for a decade now, and I consider it one of my great victories that I submitted a proposal to teach American history and the three branches of government and how our system is set up. And as soon as it was approved, gave all of my students Howard Zinn's The People's History of the United States, which is a very important book because it shows that what democratic space we have was not handed to us by the elites. In fact, the elites fought us every step of the way. And that after World War I, in the name of the Red Scare, accelerated, of course, in the 50s, there was a destruction of those radical movements, and then finally a disemboweling of the liberal class itself, and the system seized up. Clinton certainly understood that if he did corporate bidding, he would get corporate money. And by the 1990s, the Democratic Party had fundraising parity with the Republicans, and when Barack Obama ran for president in 2008, he got more. But at that point, you had a self-identified liberal class that continued to speak in that feel-your-pain language of liberalism, but betrayed working men and women. And that precipitated the nightmare that faces us now. The Democratic Party is deeply culpable for the arrival of demagogues like Trump. The Democratic Party transformed itself into the Republican Party. I've lived in Europe. The Democratic Party would be a far-right party in France. They transformed themselves into the Republican Party and pushed the Republican Party so far to the right it became insane. So 10 years ago, I wrote a book called American Fascists, The Christian Right and the War on America. Now, I come out of a religious tradition. My father was a Presbyterian minister, very involved in the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, and the gay rights movement, for which the Presbyterian Church pushed him aside. I graduated from Harvard Divinity School, and the great failing of the liberal church was, at the inception of this movement, not to call these people out for who they are, which are Christian heretics. You do not need to spend 3 years at Harvard Divinity School, as I did, to grasp that Jesus did not come to make us rich. And in the 2 years that I spent on that book, where I interviewed dozens of followers in the movement, I couldn't listen to their stories without being moved. Their despair, their struggle with addictions, with domestic and sexual abuse, jail time, gambling, so deadly to any society. And all of the writers of totalitarianism, including Hannah Arendt, see that societal despair as a starting point towards the destruction of the open society. And what these mega pastors do, almost all of whom are white men who cannot be questioned, who are narcissists, who are con artists, and who effectively prey on that despair of these people to become immensely wealthy, is perpetuate the kind of magical thinking that lies at the core of any totalitarian movement. Anthropologists call it crisis cults. That when a society disintegrates and thrusts a certain segment aside, the only way people can cope is to retreat into magical thinking, magical Jesus. You saw an example of a crisis cult in 1890 in Wounded Knee before the 7th Cavalry set up the Gatling guns and massacred those Native Americans, where they believed that if they put on the white shirt, it would stop the white man's bullets, that if they fell into this Sufi-like hypnotic dance, the buffalo herds would return, the warriors would rise up from the earth, and the white Euro-Americans and Americans would disappear. And that is essentially what the Christian right is. It is a crisis cult. The only way to break the back of this movement is to reintegrate these people back into the economy. And of course, the opposite has happened. Trump has no ideology. It's an ideological void. But that vacuum is being filled rapidly by the Christian right, the Christian fascists. And as Noam Chomsky points out, we may get rid of Trump, but Michael Pence will be worse. Nothing will protect us until we address the root cause, which is the rupture of the social bonds, the seizure of power by corporate forces, and the deep malaise and alienation that is rippling across the United States. We personalize our dilemma in a figure like Trump. But this is a grave mistake. And one of the saddest moments in contemporary American history has been the Democratic Party's refusal to address the social inequality that is driving us over a cliff. Because a figure like Trump did not arise out of this morass because of James Comey or the Podesta emails or Russian bots. But the Democratic Party is a creation of the corporate state. There's one party, it's the corporate party. On one end, you have the troglodytes and the racists, the Mercers and the Sheldon Adelsons and the Trumps and the Bannons and the Millers and the Kavanaughs. And on the other, you have the segment of the ruling corporate oligarchy embodied in the polished Princeton graduates who work at Goldman Sachs. I've taught at Princeton, I see how they recruit, who don't want to be identified as racists or homophobic or Islamophobes, but never address the structures of power, the seizure of power by these corporate forces. Ten years ago, we suffered a severe financial dislocation. And what was the response of the corporate elite? They created out of electronic ether, according to researchers at the University of Missouri, $26 trillion in fabricated money. Think of what $26 trillion could have done in terms of putting people back to work, making sure that the 8 million families that were evicted from their homes had a place to live, forgiving student debt, creating a rational health system. Where parents were not forced by corporations to go bankrupt trying to save their sick children. And these speculators, these global speculators, They took this money. They never created jobs. They never buttressed manufacturing. They bought back their own stock, which is what they did with the money they got from the virtual tax boycott. Never forget that under Eisenhower, the highest tax brackets for the wealthiest individuals and corporations was 91%. 91%. And we now live in a system where by next year we will be paying over $350 billion on interest, and within 10 years, $900 billion on interest. And they gamble. The fracking industry, aside from destroying the water on which we depend for life, is a money-losing operation. $280 billion. Because the fracking industry, like the dot-com industry, is valued not on the profit it produces, but on projected profit. And this money, this $26 trillion of money, Marx calls it fictitious capital because it will evaporate, is borrowed at virtually 0% interest from the Fed. In Europe, there were central banks that had negative interest rates, meaning they would pay you to borrow money. But it has to be paid back. And since they're not producing anything of substance, they are imposing harsher and harsher forms of austerity and debt peonage on a beleaguered population that no longer has a voice within the society. What we have done to our students, crippled by monthly payments in the hundreds, if not in the thousands of dollars, unable to find meaningful work. American productivity since 1973 has increased by 77%. And if wages kept pace with productivity, the minimum wage would be over $20 an hour. And yet, over 41 million workers in this country earn less than $12 an hour. That's a third of the workforce. And almost none of them have employee-offered health insurance. That's by design. They are extracting it from us. Even if you have health insurance in this disastrous for-profit system, your co-pays, what's not covered, astronomical pharmaceutical costs are draining you. 1 million bankruptcies a year are caused by people who can't pay medical bills and they had insurance. I'm not the only person in this room to read the climate change studies, each one more terrifying than the next, and each one with the same theme, which is it is happening far faster than we predicted. Why are climate scientists so terrified of raising global temperatures beyond 2 degrees Celsius? Because of feedback loops. And they know what feedback loops do. They've studied it on Venus, which used to have water and is now 800 degrees. And these corporate forces who kneel before the primacy of profit are not only willing to enslave us, but ultimately to push the human species to extinction. And there are no internal or external mechanisms within the systems of power that will protect us. All resistance now must be grounded in the spiritual, not in an orthodox religious belief system necessarily. I come out of that system, but I certainly saw that spiritual dimension at Standing Rock. Indeed, that was one of the most moving aspects of the resistance by the water protectors. We have to pay fealty to those non-rational forces that are belittled by the corporate state. Beauty, truth, a search for meaning, the struggle with our own mortality. We have to recapture the sacred. Because in theological terms, the forces arrayed against us are the forces of death. I was in Prague to cover the Velvet Revolution. I spent every evening in the Magic Lantern Theater with Václav Havel. And on the streets of the city that winter were posters of a young Charles University student named Jan Palach, who, to protest the 1968 Soviet invasion of his country, the overthrow of Dubček, and the installation of a pro-Soviet regime, went to the central Wenceslas Square and lit himself on fire. 4 days later, he died of his burns. His funeral, which was a non-event on state media, was broken up by the police. When his grave became a shrine, his remains were exhumed, cremated, his ashes were given to his mother, and she was told she was not allowed to rebury them. 1 week after the communist government fell, 10,000 people marched to Red Army Square and renamed it Jan Palach Square. I was in Wenceslas Square when Marta Kubasheva, the great Czech singer who had sung the anthem of defiance, a prayer for Marta broadcast over the airwaves, walked out on that balcony in that snowy December night. When the Soviets took control, they destroyed her recording stock. They banned her from the airwaves. In the intervening years, she had worked on an assembly line in a toy factory. And when she walked out on that balcony in front of 500,000 Czechs and began to sing a prayer for Marta, every Czech in the crowd knew every word. That is the moral power of resistance, the ironic point of light that flashes out wherever the just exchange their messages, and may I, composed like them of Eros and of dust, beleaguered by the same negation and despair, show an affirming flame. That is faith. That is hope. That's what hope is. It is the belief that the good draws to it the good. It is the belief that standing up against radical evil, even in the face of overwhelming odds, gives us meaning, dignity, and integrity. I'm not the only person in this room to have children, and we are responsible for the world they inherit. And even if we fail, at least let those who come after us say of us, they tried. I don't know if we will succeed. I don't even know if we will survive as a species. But I know these corporate forces have us by the throat, and they have my children by the throat. And in the end, I do not fight fascists because I will win. I fight fascists because they are fascists. Thank you. In Empire of Illusion, you bemoan the loss of a print culture as a major source of America's imploding culture. Do you feel this situation has worsened since the election of Trump and his politics of tweet? If so, what can be done at scale about it? Yes, the destruction of a print-based culture and its replacement by carefully manufactured images from corporations, the whole corruption of the political process which essentially creates manufactured personalities, has severed us from a rational kind of debate about political power and about capitalism, which is a word you will never hear on the corporate media, including MSNBC. And what's happened that's so frightening under Trump is that, yes, all governments lie, as I.F. Stone said. All politicians lie. So when Clinton sold us NAFTA, he promised that it would create well-paying middle-class jobs. It was a lie. In fact, in the book, I'm in Anderson, Indiana, one of the old GM centers, and after NAFTA, the 25,000 union UAW jobs were lost. These were jobs where people were earning $25, $30 an hour. They had pensions. They had medical benefits. They could buy a home. They could send their kids to college. It all goes to Monterrey, Mexico, where they're paying workers $3 an hour without benefits. And they didn't just abandon the factories. They bulldozed them. So there are these gigantic, massive, weed-choked lots. And they voted for Sanders, most of them, in the primaries. But in the general election, they voted for Trump. And so the process of these manufactured personalities, remember, supposedly, not me, but supposedly people wanted to have a beer with George W. Bush and not Al Gore, I mean, this kind of stuff. So it's these and Trump is a classic example of a personality that is manufactured by the media. The danger we face now under Trump, yeah, all of those in power lie, but with Trump, we get what is characteristic of a totalitarian society, and that is what Hannah Arendt calls the permanent lie. So verifiable fact, physical reality no longer matters. You can have pictures of his inauguration crowd next to Obama, and he still has the largest inauguration crowd, you know. And that's very dangerous because it further accelerates this division into a world where facts are interchangeable with opinion, that we honor information only based on how it makes us feel. As Arendt points out, it creates a kind of schizophrenia within the culture because the facts are in front of you, and yet they are denied and denied and denied. And I blame these electronic hallucinations. I worry about the severance from a print-based culture rooted in verifiable fact. The books are still there. It's Huxley. I mean, I used to wonder who's right, Huxley or Orwell. Well, it turns out they were both right, because first we got Huxley, and now we're getting the iron boot of Orwell, because the ruling ideology of neoliberalism no longer has any credibility across the political spectrum. So what happens when empires decline? There are familiar characteristics. One of them is, of course, military fiascos, such as now the 17 years of warfare in the Middle East. So all late empires engage in military fiascos. The ancient Greeks invaded Sicily, their entire fleet was sunk, most of their soldiers were killed, the empire disintegrated. The danger is severe economic mismanagement, which we already face, but the day the dollar is dropped as the world's reserve currency, then the dollar's value plummets. I'm not going to play Nostradamus with dates. But that it's coming is a fact. And the military machine has to contract. And empires are always fragile entities because they depend for their wealth on the exploitation of foreign labor and the plunder of foreign natural resources. And you saw it in the Athenian Empire. Thucydides writes, "The tyranny that Athens imposed on others, it finally imposed on itself." And that's precisely what's happening. And you use the harsher forms of control on the outer reaches of empire, wholesale surveillance, suspension of basic civil liberties, including due process, militarized police, militarized drones. It all comes back into the heart of empire. And my fear, and Cornel West and Rick Wolf and I have been going around doing these series of talks based on great revolutionary thinkers, Rosa Luxemburg, Antonio Gramsci, Karl Marx, W.E.B. Du Bois. We did Thomas Paine for our first one because we cannot sever ourselves from the wisdom of the past. That is our patrimony. That's our heritage. You can go back to Aristotle, and Aristotle understood that you can't have a democracy in an oligarchic system. As Aristotle said, once the oligarchy seizes power, then you only have two options, revolution or tyranny. That's it. And what I worry about this land of the eternal present and the land of images is that we're cutting ourselves off from our intellectual heritage at a moment that we desperately need it. You've spoken of the need for a spiritual awakening since humankind can't agree on who our Father, that's not politically correct, God is, or even whether we have a Father. Do you think it might be time to remember our Mother? Surely we all can agree that we're children of Mother Earth. Well, this is the Gaia. This is really the Gaia theory by Lovelock, that the Earth is a living being. Every society has a concept of God, but that concept is a human creation. And they endow the eternal with particular attributes, depending on whatever religious system you come out of. But they all know that there is something beyond us. There is the eternal. There is the sacred. There are these forces that give life and on which we depend for life. And that our time on Earth is very brief. I mean, human civilization, in quotes, has only existed for 10,000 years since the end of the last ice age. And the very peculiar elements of the biosphere that have made this possible, including the Gulf Stream, for most of the 4.5 billion years the Earth has been, have not been existent. It's called the Holocene, this moment, being now supplanted by the Anthropocene. So it's about being in touch with the sacred. It's about honoring, protecting the sources of life and understanding that our life with the life around us is intricately linked. What do you see as the role of third parties? Can we afford to risk wasting our vote in 2020? Well, to quote the great Emma Goldman, if voting was that effective, it would be illegal. If we don't rebuild our movements, it doesn't matter who we vote for. Power is the problem. I'm in that sense an anarchist. Power is always the problem. We are eternal heretics of power. We must remain organized to hold power accountable. As Ralph Nader has pointed out, the last liberal president in America was Richard Nixon, not because he was a liberal or had a conscience, but because he was frightened of movements. And that's how we got OSHA, the Mine and Safety Act, the Clean Water, most of it written by Nader. And there's a scene in Kissinger's memoirs, do not buy the book, where it's 1971, there are tens of thousands of anti-war demonstrators. Nixon has put empty city buses all around the White House, and he's standing at the window saying, Henry, they're going to break through the barricades and get us. And that's precisely where we want people in power to be. So I vote, but without movements, real movements. And my problem with Bernie is that, and Shama Sawant and I were with Bernie before he announced, and Shama was pushing him that he had to run as an independent. Not only are we not going to gain power through the Democratic Party, which doesn't function as a real political party, and which stole the election from Bernie, we're not going to build an effective opposition within an election cycle. It's going to take a long time. It's going to begin in places like Eugene. It's going to begin from the ground up. Syriza, 10 years ago, now the ruling party of Greece, was polling at 4%. So, you know, there does come a moment when we just have to stand up on principle, because if we don't begin to stand up, nobody else will. Well, it's a good question. Real solutions to homelessness, but it raises the cruelty of what we have done to people with mental disabilities. We have thrown them out on the street. You can see them. 25% of the prison population is severely mentally ill, and as soon as they get in prison, they drug them up so they sleep 18 hours a day because it's the only way the prison can cope is by plying them with psychotropic drugs. But it's just another example of the cruelty of unfettered capitalism, the way this society, one of the wealthiest societies still on the planet, will discard people and treat them as if they're human refuse, including, of course, children. How many high school students are homeless? How many college students? I mean, children living in shelters? And that's why this system has to be overthrown. And let me spell that out for the Homeland Security. That's O-V-E-R. We have to restructure our relationship to the planet and our relationship to ourselves. You know, how many more decades can we go without paying reparations to African Americans? I've been in Germany, and, you know, it's not a perfect society, but they confronted the evil of the Holocaust, and it made them a better society for it. We've never confronted what we've done. And let's be clear, black people built this country. No, everything has to go. I mean, education at all levels must be free. There should be a guaranteed minimum wage. There should be universal free health care for all. The fossil fuel industry and the banking industry must be nationalized. And the military machine must be radically diminished. You know, Eric Foner, when he writes about the abolitionists, says the abolitionists who had called for the emancipation of African Americans with no restitution to their slaveholders were dismissed as utopianists. And Lincoln initially had all sorts of bizarre schemes of not only compensating but sending blacks to Madagascar, I can't remember where. But what happened at the end of the Civil War is that everything the abolitionists called for came to pass. We have to begin to stand up in a real way and not be tyrannized by the practical, because we don't have any time left to recreate and reconfigure our own society. And that really means holding fast. And of course, they will attempt to frighten you. But Trump is the creation of a failed system. And you can remove Trump, but if you don't address the system itself, the deformities within the system, then especially, I fear, as we barrel towards both an ecological and an economic crisis, out of that swamp will rise figures as frightening or more frightening than Trump. Demagogues who actually have an ideology, clutching the American flag in one hand and the Christian cross in the other. We have to address the root causes that have created the sickness unto death, as Kierkegaard would say, within our society. And we're not even examining them, much less addressing them. So, yeah, go ahead and vote. But it isn't going to make, I mean, even if Bernie had, if the Democratic Party hadn't stolen and fixed the primaries to keep him out, and you know, the tragedy, of course, is that in most polls, I think almost all polls, in a one-on-one contest, Sanders would have beat Trump. But he would have been completely paralyzed by Mitch McConnell and all the other troglodytes. I mean, let's be clear. that he would have been powerless without movements. I mean, I was with, when I wrote Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, which is out of the worst sacrifice zones in America, with the great cartoonist Joe Sacco, I was interviewing Ken Heckler, who had actually fought for miners in West Virginia. He was in his 90s when I interviewed him. And there was the Black Lung compensation bill got before Nixon's desk. And Nixon didn't want to sign it because the coal industry was dead set against paying. And Heckler called a news conference and said, if Nixon doesn't sign it in 24 hours, the entire coal industry in the United States will cease to produce and we will have an energy crisis. And Nixon signed it. And Heckler said, I didn't really know if they were going to. But that's how power works. And they've taken from us our power, and we have to rebuild our movement so we can pit power against power. So what offers the most inspiration to you on a daily basis? It's my students in the prison who live under conditions both before they got into prison and in prison that very few of us in this room could endure. It's their integrity, their brilliance, their courage to resist. They just led a nationwide work stoppage in the prisons, commissary boycotts, hunger strikes. Because they said the only way to stop slavery is to stop being a slave. And that's a lesson for all of us, because it isn't going to be easy. Look at Standing Rock, a nonviolent protest, over 700 arrests, constant surveillance, infiltration, attack dogs. There were mercenaries all over that. By the time I got there in November, they'd blocked all the roads. I had to go all the way around. But I was being stopped on the roads by these guys dressed in black, in Kevlar vests, with long-barreled weapons, with no identification. All hired by Dapple. There were constant planes and drones filming everything. Water cannons laced with pepper spray, unleashed on the crowd in sub-zero temperatures. And that was Obama. It's going to be a nasty fight. But as I have learned from my students, it is that act of resistance that in that moment makes you free. It's what Reinhold Niebuhr calls sublime madness in the soul. So we've got to reconfigure the question as they have done. We've got to stop asking, will we succeed? The only question now is it right?
You were just listening to Chris Hedges on Root Causes of a Failed System. He spoke in Eugene, Oregon. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening.
KABU Community Radio is requesting proposals for a grant writer to provide ongoing grant writing services and application support. This is a one-year contract position for 200 hours, compensated at $25 an hour. Proposals must be submitted electronically to Delphine Crescenzo, station manager at Dell, that's D-E-L, at KABU.FM. Proposals are due Friday, January 4th at 5 p.m. Responsibilities, background information, the scope of work, and proposal requirements can be found at kabu.fm/grantwriter2018.
Hi, I'm J.J. Johnson, host of the Gospel and More program, Sundays from 6 to 8 a.m. We are collecting yarn to make wool caps for the homeless community. Drop off yarn and caps at KBOO 20 Southeast 8th, Monday through Fridays, 9 to 5. We are also looking for knitters. For more information, contact KBOO Gospel and More at gmail.com or go to KBOO.FM/gospel and more. The yarn and cap drive will end January the 31st.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Hope you all are enjoying celebration or relaxation on this beautiful Christmas day. Coming up on KBOO at 10, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, and 11, Peace, Love, and Soup presents a holiday special, A Big Bowl of Wassail. But first, I'm going to give a shout out to Robert, an old mountain climbing friend of mine who enjoys hearing Celtic-inspired music on Christmas Day. Here are two cuts from Kevin Burke's and John Brennan's CD, The Pound Ridge Sessions. Enjoy.